Kelly's Heroes.
Next on Kelly's Heroes, it's the iconic Tom Robinson, once known as a gay punk rebel and rock's most radical musician. Not only a brilliant broadcaster, but a fantastic songwriter. Tom, let me just start by saying I think you're brilliant on the radio. You've got a great voice, lovely tone. I think it really suits that medium.
It's how I got into radio. That's the whole thing. In 1985, or maybe even 84, a BBC World Service producer came along to see one of my shows, and I thought, oh, she's going to put my music on the radio.
Brilliant.
And she came backstage and said, I really like the bits in between the songs when you talk to the audience. Would you like to do your own radio show? And, yeah, it was accidental, really.
What was she called?
Annie Bristow has much to answer for. Yeah, she's a World Service producer.
Do you reckon you could put a word in for me?
I definitely will, yes, if she's still there. Although this was 1984, so how old were you then?
13, about 13.
There you go. Yeah, you might have been a bit young for it at the time. So when did you first use your voice to earn a living?
Oh, do you mean as an actor or as a voiceover artist?
Well, both. I mean, because you can't do the acting without the voice, can you?
Well, I suppose it was when I left drama school when I was 21, and my first ever job was my first ever audition, and I played the lead opposite a little-known American actor called Harvey Keitel. Yeah, exactly. I thought, this is
wow.
Easy. This is the way it's meant to be.
It's always going to be like this.
Exactly. I was like, you know, move over Thomas Cruise. There's a new gun in town.
It was just the same for me with the modestly named Tom Robinson Band. We put out our first single, and it went to number 4 in the charts, 2468 Motorway, and we thought, that's it, it's every record we do is going to be a hit from now on.
Well, yeah, I love that song. Can't get that song out of my head. 2468, never too late. I've got a question about that.
Yeah.
Is that a song about doing drugs on the motorway? Well, is it? Spill the beans. There's something else to that song. Come on.
Well, yeah. In those days, bands used to slog up and down the M1 in transit vans.
Yeah.
And when you couldn't afford a road crew, you used to have to obviously drive yourselves. So we could never afford to stay in a guest house or anything after the gig, so you always had to drive back wherever you were in the country.
Yeah.
So inevitably, you'd be coming down the M1 as the sun was coming up.
Nice.
And if you were doing the driving, then you had the motorway sun coming up with the morning light. It was as simple as that. And I had this song about trucking down the motorway, but I didn't have a chorus for it. But then I remembered that I'd been on gay pride demos, where people used to chant 2468, gay is twice as good as straight. 3579, lesbians are mighty fine. So I thought, if 1,000 people can chant that, then that's a good chorus.
So you nicked it then?
Absolutely stole it, yeah.
Well, you know what, mate? Don't worry about that. You know what? Nothing's original. It's all from the Romans and the Greeks.
I suppose it is. Yeah, although a lot of people think I can't count past 9, you know, that's the...
So, Tom, this show is basically, we start off with the kids' questions, we talk about your career and your life a little bit, and then we end with a lovely sing-song.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm wondering what your kids have dreamt up for me.
Here's a brilliant question from Frida, okay? If you found a lamp and it had a genie in it and you rubbed it and the genie came out, what 3 wishes would you want?
And did she think to say you're not allowed to wish for more wishes?
Because that's... She didn't mention that. It's a little caveat.
She should have thought of that one, because that's the loophole. That's the loophole we've got to go for. There was a great story about how, I think it was the New York Times, rang up all the functionaries and dignitaries in Washington to ask them what they wished for Christmas. And...
Yeah.
The French ambassador said, oh, world peace, I think, you know. And another one said, oh, an end to world starvation. And they rang up the British ambassador. Yeah. And he was so conscious that you're not supposed to accept bribes or anything. They said, what would you like for Christmas? He said, oh, a small box of crystallised fruit. And that's what was printed in the paper. An end to world suffering, an end to world hunger, a redress of the global banking system, and a small box of crystallised fruit.
So is that your wish, Tom?
I'm going for the small box of crystallised fruit. That's my blanket wish, yeah, definitely.
So, Tom, can I take you back to when you were 16? Am I right in thinking that you had a nervous breakdown?
Yes, that's exactly right. Because, the thing is, you know, I grew up in the 60s, so yeah. I became a teenager before it was legal to be gay. So there were no queer role models out there. There's nobody telling you it's all right, you can have a happy life. So when I was 16 and I was in love with another boy at school, I didn't dare to tell him. And in the end, I tried to kill myself.
Oh my god!
You know, in age 16.
Wow, was it a scary time to be gay, do you think?
Well, you know what? I've since met people who were cheerfully and happily gay my age in the 60s and were just having a whale of a time. So I think I was probably predisposed to depression anyway at that time. And so that I can't blame it all on homophobia.
Do you think that it being illegal made it more difficult for you?
Yeah, I didn't mind. The only way the legality of it impacted on me was that there was nobody to tell me it was okay, because there weren't any open role models. So it just seemed like the future was going to be a life of dirty raincoats and public toilets, you know.
Did you envisage it being a bit like the movies?
Exactly. That was the way it was portrayed back then.
So you had a nervous breakdown at this point?
I did. I had a nervous breakdown. But then I was very lucky. Because of the breakdown, I then got the help I needed, and I spent 6 years in a therapeutic community, which completely saved my life and turned my life around. So, no question. At age 23, I moved to London, cut ties with my family, and just decided to live openly from then on. And I went to the opposite extreme, really, from it being such a shameful, guilty secret I didn't want to live with it anymore. I literally made a song and dance about it.
You did indeed. You did indeed. Well, let's talk about that song, Glad to Be Gay. That is an amazing song. Well, would I be right in calling that a protest song?
Yeah, definitely a protest. Yeah, definitely that.
Have things improved a lot for the LGBT community since that song was written?
Well, the first thing to say is that gay back then meant something different from what it means now. Now it just means men who only like men.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's that kind of small sector of the whole LGBTQ plus community. Back then, it meant everybody, everything non-heterosexual.
Yeah.
Everything that wasn't kind of vanilla straight was considered gay.
Yeah.
So when we had the Gay Liberation Front, that was for everyone. And Gay News, that was for everyone. Gay Switchboard, Gay Sweatshop Theatre Company. So Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay meant Sing If You're Glad to Be Different. So it later turned out I was actually bisexual. You know, but Sing If You're Glad to Be Bisexual doesn't work. It doesn't scan. And above all, you know, it's like the discussions we're having about race now.
Yep.
People talking about if you have one parent of Afro-Caribbean origin and one person of white Anglo-Saxon British origin, you're generally considered black when you go out and about. You know, the racists are still going to call you black. And it's the same thing if you're bisexual. You know, the queer basher isn't going to spare you just because you've got a girlfriend.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's just by the by. It is in a much better position for our community at this point. But there's always a pendulum swing. At the same time, women's rights have kind of moved on some, but nothing like as much as we'd hoped. And in terms of racial equality, that's still, well, again, much better, but a long way to go.
How important is that song and you for the LGBT community?
Yeah, I think people of a certain generation remember that. But, you know, they published the kind of the pink list, the kind of 100 power gays. It's a difference between being possibly historically significant and actually influential. There's so much going on now. It's such a big, powerful thing. And I'm living quietly on the kind of male-to-female end of the spectrum, so that I've been married to my wife since 1990. And I don't know. That's the thing about being bisexual, is that you're perceived according to who you're walking around with rather than, you know, who you feel yourself affiliated with.
I think someone like Russell T Davies must be very important. I mean, a show like Queer as Folk was very important.
That really was groundbreaking.
Kelly's Heroes.
Can I take you to Hammersmith Odeon? Is it true that you kissed your keyboard player full on the lips?
That is true, yeah. Ian Parker was the keyboard player at that time.
And what was the reaction from the crowd?
Well, you know, it was only a year since nobody had ever heard of us or the song. So I thought the world hasn't changed that much in this time, you know. So I thought that actually, with Ian's permission, going over and giving him a kiss on the lips, I'd previously arranged with him that that was all right. So it was when I gave him a kiss, and this sort of shockwave ran through the audience, this wave of,
really?
Yeah, because it's one thing to sing about it as a general idea, but a whole other thing to see it and see what it actually means, men being intimate with each other. And, the story I always tell about that, and, you know, I've told it so many times, I think, did that really happen? But it did. It did really happen. There were two guys at the back of the stalls. A friend of mine was in the seat behind them, and they were up on their feet singing along with the song, waving their hands in the air. And when I stopped the song and kissed Ian, one of them turned to the other and said, "Ian, you know what? I reckon these geezers are bent." So, yeah. But, you know, it's worth remembering anytime one is tempted to think, oh, yeah, me and my song, we changed the world. No, you didn't. It's the audience that changed the world.
Yeah.
It's the people who were in that audience singing it along and who went out and changed the world, and, you know, the gay people who came out and the straight people who picked other people up on homophobic jokes. But also, hopefully, the Rock Against Racism thing we were doing at the time, you know, was also contributing and helping change values just in the audience, and then it was them that would go out and fight for things in the society itself. So I think, you know, the music acts as a sort of tonic for the troops, really.
Wasn't it the great late John Peel who played Glad to Be Gay first?
Better than that, he was the only DJ on Radio 1 who defied the management ban on the song and played it anyway. So none of my records got played, or certainly none of them got playlisted on Radio 1 until War Baby, sort of 5-6 years later.
Are you influenced by John Peel?
Of course. You know, every music broadcaster in the country, if not the world, is kind of influenced by John to some extent. I first knew him in the 60s. I used to write to him before he went to the BBC when he was a pirate radio DJ. And as a fan of his programme, I used to send him fan letters on, which he read on board the ship.
Wow.
When he had nothing else to do but answer fan mail.
Wow.
So years later...
Did he write back?
Oh, yeah, he always replied. I've got a great stack of handwritten John Peel letters still.
Oh, that's amazing.
Because, like, for 22 hours of the day, he was stuck on board a ship with Tony Blackburn.
Tony Blackburn? Christ.
Yeah, and nothing to do during the daytime except reply to the mail. So he wrote back to everybody. He's a nice man. Anyway, Peel is a big kind of inspiration. But you have to say these days, it's a very different landscape in Radioland. So BBC Introducing has a whole raft of DJs all across the country, all doing what John Peel did, all listening to the kind of incoming stuff, trying to make it possible for people to get heard without a major record label and without insider contacts and without having to know the right people to get your record heard, or and especially without having to pay money to a plugger.
Is there anyone at the moment that you're excited by?
I get excited pretty much on a weekly basis, to be honest, because I listen to about 200 tracks a week. My ears are tuned to what you could call A&R mode. A&R mode. So that's... You know, as people know, that's the department of the record company that signs new talent. So that you always had to impress the A&R people at the record company if you wanted to get signed to them. And you had to be signed to a record label, because otherwise you had no chance of being allowed to make a record. And even then, you had to be signed to a record label, because without a plugger to get your stuff onto the radio, you had no chance of anybody ever hearing your record. And it's so, so different now, because anybody with a laptop can make a studio quality record. All you need is a pair of ears, basically, and the loan of a laptop. And similarly, YouTube means you don't have to have a record label. You could just put it out there. And if it is a killer song, if it is the next Ghost Town...
What a song that is. Still very, very relevant.
Do you know what I mean? If you put that video up there related to today's situation, you know, and it was as good as that, then of course the likes and the shares are going to just rack up. And in the end, the music industry will come to you rather than the other way around. I mean, but it does have to be a very, very, very good song for that to happen.
Yeah, I had the great honour of speaking to Terry Hall just a few weeks ago, and you know, I was telling him about how important that song was to me and how it affected me. In fact, it got me to write my first couple of songs. I wrote a song called Wheelie Wheel, and the B-side was called Being Unemployed.
Are you going to sing it for us later?
Oh, I'll sing it for you now.
Go on then.
Wheelie wheel, that's what I do on my bike, all day, all night, not a care in the world about anyone else but me on my mean machine. Bunny ups, donkey kicks, a million off ramps, jumping ditches, horse jumping fences over the walls. Side ons, full turns, wheelie wheel, that's what I do on my bike, all day, all night.
I think we should have a video of that on your Instagram account.
Yeah, it got out of storm, wouldn't it? And the B-side was called Being Unemployed. Yeah, I was writing songs about social injustice at 10.
Really? At age 10?
Yeah, because I was influenced by Ghost Town and the Specials. Do you want to hear a story?
Yeah.
I had a pen pal in Canada. And she wrote to me and she said, oh, you know, you're cute, you got a nice picture. What's your favourite colour? I said red. And then I wrote back to her and I said, can you tell me how many people are unemployed in Canada? Because in Britain, it's nearly 4 million. And I, for one, think that's an outrage. She didn't get back to me. Tom, would you mind if we went back? It's just occurred to me that I didn't really go into detail about when you were 16 and you had that breakdown, and I feel it's an important question. And that place that you went to, because you spent 6 years of your life there, would that be okay to talk about that?
Yeah. Of course, yeah. I didn't want to dwell on it for you, but I'll happily expand.
Yes. How did it change you? How did it help you? Because it occurs to me that it's an extremely important time.
Well, this place was called Finchton Manor, and it was a one-off. There's never been anything like it, quite like it, before or since, because it was just run by one man who by that point was in his 70s. And it was a private house a beat-up old manor house in the wilds of Kent. And there were about 50 boys, 10 staff, 10 dogs, and any number of cats, all living together in unheated rooms in a community atmosphere. Basically, there were four meals a day, no punishments, no rules, but certain traditions. And we did our own cooking, we did the cleaning, we were responsible for everything. So each boy had to take his turn cooking for the whole house. And we took it in turns to do the washing up, and if you didn't do your washing up, there wasn't a punishment for it, it was just nobody could eat. So that's how community life works, and how basically group therapy works. Anyway, again, I've told this story a few times before, but it's worth saying that I didn't know what I was going to when I went down for the interview to see if I could get in. But I was just told that there was this man who was very good at helping boys with problems. And I'd been in a mental hospital, I'd been given drugs, I'd been...
A mental hospital?
Yeah, after the breakdown, they took me off to mental hospital. And basically, I was collected from the school, taken to this wing of Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, and told to put my pyjamas on because I was ill, and told to get into bed because I was ill, and they took my temperature.
Yeah.
And they medicalised the whole thing. That's the thing about homosexuality... is seen either as a sin or as a crime or as a disease. That's how it worked in the 60s. It was one of those three. So I was lucky in a sense that I wasn't being cast out, having my demons cast out, or being locked up, but I was being treated as a patient in a hospital for a disease.
At 16.
And they showed me ink blot tests, and asked me to free associate, and the psychiatrist asked me about the images that I saw at night when I closed my eyes, the eidetic images. Oh, it's just nonsense. It was complete psychiatric anyway.
Sounds depressing.
It was completely depressing. And they said, you've got to take these drugs. And they gave me drugs every 6 hours, pills. I don't know what the they were.
Jesus, this sounds horrific.
Well, you know. They were trying to save my life, so...
Okay, yeah.
It's true, and...
They don't still do that, do they?
No, they don't do that anymore, but they do try and save your life if they can. But my poor old dad was... My dad was very... He was very strict as a father. But out of love, because he was a self-made man and he wanted his children to be motivated to succeed and get on and get a good job. So he was always going on at us to do better at school, this, that and the other. And he came to visit me in the hospital and said, don't worry, we'll get you out of here and back to school in no time, back to your A-levels. And I said to him, Dad, when I get out of here, I'm just going to do the job properly. And poor man, he crumpled. This tower of strength, this strict, stern, self-contained, powerful man just crumpled up, and tears came out of his eyes, and he hadn't used his tear ducts for so long. This kind of white stuff started to come out of his eyes, and he just collapsed on my bed sobbing and said, I don't want to lose you. And that was the first time it properly dawned on me. My dad actually loved me. Yeah. He didn't see me as this kind of embarrassment or this thing that wouldn't succeed or this failure or anything. That it was coming from a place of love. So, anyway, the thing is, it wouldn't have got to all that stage if there had been the kind of support systems we have in place today. Today,
absolutely,
people who feel suicidal, people who are suffering from depression, can call helplines. Kids who are having trouble with their sexuality can call helplines. People of any age who are having trouble with their sexual identity can call helplines. But particularly depression, because it's so widespread, particularly with lockdown and everything. I've battled it all my life, depression. It comes, it goes.
Sorry to hear that, Tom.
Yeah. But I'm so, so glad that I didn't succeed back then. I would have missed out on such an interesting life, so many amazing experiences, including, you know, a lot of great sex and the joys of parenthood and a family and the wonder of seeing your kids grow up.
Of course.
All that, none of that would have happened if I'd succeeded. You can't know what's going to happen in the future. It gets better is the message.
I'm so glad you didn't do it, Tom, and you got through it. I'm so pleased that you got through that dark period. And so did your father get you out of there and take you to this place?
Yeah, he took me. He then came and collected me from school a couple of months later, because I was allowed to go back to the school so long as I kept seeing a psychiatrist. And he picked me up and drove me down to Kent, and we drove into this kind of wildly overgrown, rambling kind of estate. And at the end of it was this gravel drive and this Jacobean manor house where the windows had been broken and mended and broken and mended countless times, kind of really ramshackle. And this row of faces appeared at the window staring at us as we came in. But then I got shown into the study where this old kind of hunched man, tortoise of a man, he looked like an old tortoise with this old sports jacket on and his plastic kind of misty spectacles halfway down his nose. And he didn't look like a kind of authority figure or anything, but he just had an incredible charisma. And as he came towards me, he looked over the glasses and looked straight into my eyes. And he took my hand, which I offered to shake it, and it didn't let go. He held on to it for longer than was comfortable. And he looked straight in my eyes and he went, "Hello," I said, "you're very lonely, aren't you?" And, you know, after all the psychiatry and the drugs and the ink blot tests and all the of the medical profession, here at last was somebody who looked straight into my eyes and knew what the trouble was. It wasn't that I was queer. It was that I was lonely. I was depressed. And I thought I was alone in the world. And I talked to him for an hour and it was like, finally, somebody understands, you know? And, yeah, I went round, I saw this terrifying place with all these wild, ragged boys running around shouting, and it's called Finchton Manor. I've put together a website for Finchton, F-I-N-C-H-D-E-N, Manor. I went back to see the chief, Mr. Lywood, and he said, "Right, well, we're full up. We haven't got any places. In any case, we don't normally take boys as sick as you." And it was like he knew that if there was any kind of sliding around it, then I'd probably have gone, "Oh, well, let me go and make my mind up." He just gave me a snap, jump with both feet or f*** off. And I leapt. It was just a chance of life.
Tough love.
And I grabbed it with both hands. I said, "Yes, please." And went there and stayed 6 years. And it was like seizing life. And that's what you've got to do. If you're depressed, if you're down, you've got to seize life with both hands because it's a precious thing.
Yes,
and
it is.
However dark it gets, you know, you don't know what's around the corner. You don't know what's going to come.
Exactly.
And the help is there, which it wasn't for me back then. So if anyone's listening to this who's battling depression, for goodness sake, get help.
Yeah.
Nobody else can help you. You've got to get the help yourself.
So you went into therapy then? So that was just what it was, just like therapy?
No, I mean, this is over the course of the last 70 years, you know, that's basically when it's got bad, that's what I've had to resort to. So I had another breakdown in my 30s.
Really?
Just as I was 30. And
do you want to talk about that, Tom?
Sure, very briefly. Yeah, I was just getting more and more depressed episodes, and I was kind of staying indoors for 2 or 3 days at a time with the door locked and not answering the phone. And I was going to the doctor complaining of fictional back pain so that I could get powerful painkillers to do the deed with.
Really?
Wow.
So serious?
Yeah, I was stocking up in the cupboard.
So what stopped you?
It was Prick Up Your Ears, the Joe Orton biography. John Lahr wrote this great biography. And it was just obvious in that book that Joe Orton knew that his lover, Kenneth Halliwell, was going to murder him sooner or later.
Yeah.
And he kept saying to his friends, I must get around to leaving Kenneth. It's not good for me. I really will leave him. And he never did. He just let it slide. And I just saw, if I let it slide, one dark night, I was going to go to that bathroom cupboard and that would be it. So I had this realisation. I flushed all the drugs down the toilet. I picked up the phone. I called my manager and said, find me a shrink. I don't care what kind of psychiatry it is, but whatever it is, I'm going to commit to it.
Brilliant.
And I did 10 years of psychotherapy.
Excellent.
And at the end of the 10 years, that's when my first kid was born.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
So there you go. It was a long journey.
That's an amazing thing. So, Tom, what song are we going to sing today?
Well, the thing is, you know folk music and folk festivals. There's the most hardcore of the folk festivals, as far as I can ascertain, is the Sidmouth Folk Festival.
Do they actually exist?
Yeah. Because there are some that allow a certain amount of pop music in. But the Sidmouth one is very hardcore, with hardcore Morris dancing and all the rest of it. The really terrifying guys that have the big staves and kind of Morris dancers you would not want to mess with on a dark night. Yeah. Anyway, I got invited to a lunchtime pub session, as they call them, at the Sidmouth Folk Festival. Somebody said, you've got to come along to this. So I did. And it was so hardcore because it was so hardcore that no instruments were allowed. It was all unaccompanied singing in a pub. And they were all like traditional ballads about miners or whatever, you know. And I didn't know any. And I knew that sooner or later it was going to come my turn and I'd have to sing something. So I told them that I'd mentioned to my family that I was going to a folk festival. And my infant son had suggested that I should sing Rickety Tickety Tin, because that's what he thought was a folk song. So using my son as an excuse to sing a Tom Lehrer song to an audience of traditional folk fans. And, of course, it's got a sing-along chorus.
Yeah.
Everybody could join in with the Rickety Tickety Tin. So once they'd forgiven me for starting it, then I actually managed to get through the whole song. And it was...
They got stuck in?
Yeah, they joined in with a good grace, because I was showing willing, you know what I mean? I wasn't saying, I've got to sing 2, 4, 6, 8 Motorway. It wasn't that. It was like, let's have an a cappella song then.
Right, well, look, I do a little mouth organ ritual analysis. So let's get a note.
Okay. Okay, yep, I've got that. I'm going to sing it in the style of Tom Waits rather than Tom Lehrer, if that's all right.
Hit it.
Okay, here we go. About a maid, I'll sing a song. Rickety-tickety-tin. About a maid, I'll sing a song. She did not have her family long. Not only did she do them wrong, she did every one of them in. She did every one of them in. One morning in the fit of pique, sing rickety-tickety-tin. One morning in a fit of pique, she drowned her father in the creek. The water tasted bad for a week. And we had to make do with gin, with gin. We had to make do with gin. And when at last the police came by, rickety-tickety-tin. And when at last the police came by, her little pranks she did not deny. To do so she would have had to lie. And lying she knew was a sin, a sin. Yes, lying she knew was a sin.
Oh, that was brilliant, Tom. You actually sounded like Tom Waits, mate. You should do a cover of that. I want a cover out by Christmas. Let's do a cover, man. That was amazing. I was just smiling away there.
Oh, thank you very much.
Great rendition.
We got a bit of rickety-tickety, didn't
we? We did. Tom, you've been an amazing guest. Thank you so much, man.
Craig, Kelly, you are my hero.
Well, thanks very much, Tom. You're my hero too, mate.
Thanks. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye, mate.
Next time on Kelly's Heroes, I chat to the wonderful actor, Julie Graham. So until then, stay happy.